Hi guys! This week's episode of Loose Cannon is a little bit different, because Justin isn't with me, as I recorded it at Fantastic Fest in Austin. It's also a little bit different because due to technical failure, I had to stitch it back together. So if there's any parts of this podcast we're confused as to what's going on in the movie we're discussing, it's probably because we're talking about a Joe Sarno film. Enjoy! Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of Loose Cannons. This week's episode of Loose Cannons is coming direct to you from Fantastic Fest. And I'm your host, Matthew Kumar. I'm afraid Justin Duclos is not with us because he couldn't come for, you know, the fact that it costs a lot of money to get Austin and so on. And I'm instead here with...
Peter Koplowski, a short film programmer for Fantastic Fest and audience member of the film that we are about to talk about, which is not a canon film, am I right?
Yes, the film that we are going to talk about is My Body Hungers, which is a Joe Sarno picture from 1967. If you're not familiar with Loose Cannons, which you may not be, this is a podcast in which we are attempting to watch every single canon film, chronologically more or less, that is available to watch. And more or less, that's driving us crazy. We haven't seen very many good ones, but one of the things that we really noticed early on is that a lot of the early canon pictures were Joe Sarno films. So we had Inga, we had The Love Rebellion, which is actually the very first canon film, I believe, is a Joe Sarno film from about 1967 as well. And so we're kind of interested in Joe Sarno because his movies are incredibly boring kitchen sink dramas, which are supposed to be erotic because they're obviously part of that sort of 42nd Street, New York kind of grindhouse exploitation cinema thing, but they're so kind of almost like a impressionistic, you know, black and white films that we end up watching. So at Fantastic Fest this year, Nicholas Winding Refn, who you may know from, you know, Drive and the Push Trilogy and films like that, he's putting out a book called The Act of Seeing, which is entirely about the sort of the poster art of that era. And as a result, he programmed several films of Fantastic Fest. So we programmed X-Rated Supermarket, mm-hmm. Which is not a canon film and not one that we have, that I know anything about. Did you see it, Peter?
No, I missed it. I heard it was pretty much a hardcore pornography.
It is called X-Rated Supermarket, yeah. I guess.
It's basically just people having sex in a supermarket.
Fair enough. Yeah, and they also, on the Sunday, shortly before they showed My Body Hungers, they actually showed a movie which we've talked about in this podcast, Goodbye, Uncle Tom.
Though it was Farewell, Uncle
programmed
Tom?
As Farewell, Uncle Tom. It's actually called Adio, Uncle Tom Adio, which mm-hmm. is, I guess you can translate as either Goodbye or Farewell. I don't know why these, because most places would call it Goodbye, Uncle Tom. But here at Fantastic Fest, I guess they wanted to give a little more grandeur, I suppose. So they went with Farewell.
Maybe Farewell because, you know, people are going to see it again. We're going to see it again.
They're
not saying goodbye to this movie.
If you've listened to the Farewell, Uncle Tom podcast, you will know that I more or less considered that film justifiable to watch. And it was kind of interesting to watch I think it was Devin Faraci who did the introduction. More or less see the people at Fantastic Fest bend over backwards to try and sort of justify and prepare the audience for what they were going to watch. But, you know, not too much interesting came out of that screening, to be honest, I think.
Except you won a prize.
Except I won a prize. I did, in fact, win the Act of Seeing book, so... you know, good for me. It's very expensive. It's like $100.
So we're going to talk about My Body Hungers.
Yes, and... which I roped Peter in to see because he is a friend of the podcast and a member of the Laser Blast Film Society, as well as a jet-setting film programmer.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, so you haven't seen any Joe Sarno films.
Nope. But, you know, I was kind of impressed. In a sense. I mean, it is boring, as you say, but I thought it looked terrific. I thought it was frequently interesting, if not exciting. But I'm not seeing exactly where this appeal for Joe Sarno comes yet, because it seemed like Nicholas Winding Refn and Alan Jones, who's the writer of the book that we've been talking about, and Tim Lee, they were all very excited to see it. None of them had seen it either.
Yeah. We should talk a little bit about the introduction to this movie, which I found kind of gobsmacking. As someone who has seen 3 Joe Sarno films at that point. I've seen 4 now. Tim League came out and he said to the audience quite boldly, Joe Sarno is a hero to us here at the Draft House. So he was really selling it hard, sort of explaining what a fantastic filmmaker he was, so interesting.
It seemed to be all about one film, Confessions of a Shop Girl or something.
Like, yeah, there's one called that, and I think Refn later referenced one called something like Ride the Pink Horse, I think. Which, again, this is all from this period of time, which is the same period of the films that myself and Justin have talked about, Inga and 200 My Love Lisa. It's something that when we talked earlier about the films, the other films, is that Joe Sarno is not a bad filmmaker. It's clearly obvious. It's just that he's kind of... he's working in a milieu which is involving him making the movies in, like, about 4 days. Mm-hmm. And although he can set up good shots, he doesn't necessarily have good actors mm-hmm. or a good script to work on. Even though, for example, in this one, and I can't remember if Inga and 200 My Love, he necessarily wrote them. But definitely this one, My Body Hungers, he's listed as having written this one. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of slapdash if it has some interesting, I guess, it's mechanics to make it work.
Yeah, you know? And there's weird digressions. It very feels like art house sleaze.
But speaking of sleaze, there was some genuinely uncomfortable moments before the screening I found.
Oh, yes.
Because... the first thing we got was 2 trailers for other Joe Sarno films.
From his hardcore period.
Because basically, roughly mid-70s, after his period of kind of these softcore-ish movies that we've talked about already with Canon, he just basically had to go into hardcore. And so we saw two trailers, Slippery When Wet mm-hmm. and The Honey Cup. And I gotta be honest with you, Peter, I didn't look at the screen because I just was like, I just don't want to watch... you know, Wing Wangs going to Hoo Hoo's.
Well, you also missed sausages, like actual like kebab sausages going to Hoo Hoo's.
Oh my god! I don't... So, my question to you is: having gone to watch My Body Hungers, could you see any of the artistry of or any of the plotting,
yeah, you know
the
what?
Complex plotting
yes,
in those
because,
trailers?
Because I mean, the trailers were heavy on the penetration shots, which I thought was odd. I thought it was kind of odd that the trailers would. Just front load it with that and not kind of tease, like, I guess there's gonna be no surprises for the audience, but you know, what do I know about porno marketing? But what they did have is they had the occasional plot moment and it did feel like it was rhyme. There was one moment where just a woman enters a room and a guy sort of staying in the room and she makes sort of an innuendo statement and he just gives like a knowing look that's not quite at the camera, but it was also just a sort of awkwardly long moment that, after watching My Body Hungers, I'm like, yeah, it's pure Sarno. Nothing happening. Characters standing there. But there was none of that that dancing around, which you say is a big Sarno staple in the softcore. It's just women dancing around, but not really dancing so much as flailing in the background. But yes, what's this movie about, Matthew?
My Body Hungers. So actually, from the programmer's notes, I was kind of expecting sort of more a genre picture, I guess, because it's sort of written up as if it's kind of like his sort of genre film, as it
or
were.
Or even like a giallo of sorts,
yeah.
Because it is about a murder.
Yeah, so the film opens with like almost... these sequences always make me think of Faster Pussycat Kill Kill, where it's like a bunch of older men in suits are watching go-go dancers, basically. And, you know, so Sarno, as we know, sort of comes from the same era as Russ Meyer and so on. But while that's going on, a woman who... I don't even remember what she looks like... basically, she gets murdered with a garter belt, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then, straight after that, we get what I consider to be... I guess it's just that this film was clearly shot fast. Joe Sarno's kind of his idea. How am I going to make the exposition of this movie get by fast? Which is, he goes for the news report. It's a classic way to cheat out your exposition. So he just has a person explaining there had been a murder, and you know, girl was killed with a garter belt... and, God, my notes are so bad. So I had to do my notes for this movie, you know, in the dark, because we were in the cinema, unlike normally. So I have just scribbles everywhere here.
Well, as Matthew was saying, it begins with after the murder, we then get a news report that provides exposition.
But actually, do you know what? I'm realizing I'm discussing this wrong, because he actually describes that there has been a murder.
Yeah.
Then he says, a reenactment.
Yes,
like,
that's true.
As if what we watch is actually a reenactment of the murder. Not the murder, even though it's got all the same people and actors.
You just made me realize that this movie could be like an early version of the Pootie Tang joke where we're watching a talk show and they're like, now let's cut to the clip, and the clip is just the whole movie. The whole movie could be a reenactment of this that we're watching on the news. That might be an interpretation.
Well, there's some very strange stuff that they reenact then. But that's why we had Peter on the podcast, because only he will bring up Pootie Tang immediately.
Yeah, well, I'm the one, I am always about like weird references. Because I was also going to ask, like, I wonder what was the first film to kind of come up with that conceit. I mean, I feel like they probably came from sort of 40s sort of procedurals where you would just have, you would just cut to a news reporter occasionally to fill in plot information.
I mean, it's like, I mean, isn't it just the equivalent of the title card, you know, except done in a way that seems more normal to
except
the 60s
it's throughout,
audience.
It's throughout the movie. Like, yeah. That's the thing. It's not just exposition for the start, but every 15 minutes, much like the movie Things, if you've seen that, they'll just cut to a news reporter that is saying plot information that's sometimes very tangential or not even that related to the plot, and then other times, like, very on point. But as Matthew said, it begins with this woman getting murdered, and then we quickly, after the news report sets that murder up, we're now with the sister of the murdered girl, and she's on a trip to visit her sister, I think?
Yeah, she's going to work with her sister.
Yeah.
Basically, this film centers around, I guess, like a go-go dance bar, basically, mm-hmm. where, so the girl who was murdered was called Janet. Do you remember what the actual girl we follow is called?
I forget, only because she changes her name when she gets a job at the lodge.
That is true.
Because she was under an alias. Because she basically learns that her sister was murdered, and now she wants to get a job in the same lodge and try to find out who the murderer was.
But before she does that, she meets a trucker and has sex with him. I was like, thankfully off screen.
Yeah.
And apparently that trucker was Joe Sarno.
Except Colin, who was Colin Geddes of Midnight Madness and TIFF, and was sitting beside me and was like, oh, that's not Joe Sarno.
Well, there we go. The panel did not have any idea what was going on.
He's like, that's definitely not Joe Sarno.
So. Okay. I love how much misinformation there is.
What I like is that when she enters, when she arrives at the lodge, she arrives during, I guess, a kind of town meeting that's happening at the lodge because this woman has been murdered. And you really do get a good sense of the community. There's a cop. There's a suspect who was actually engaged with the main character's sister who was murdered. And his alibi is his mother, because apparently he was working at the newspaper factory. There's a bartender with a bow tie, who I was giving him shifty looks because he just had a bow tie and occasionally would look at the actors during conversation scenes, and I couldn't figure out if that's because he wasn't a great actor and was just decided to start listening to the actors while they're acting, or if like he was meant to be a red herring.
I actually, you know, I was bored during this movie. I got really distracted by the bartender as well, because I was remembering how, like, in all these old movies, and there was a bartender uniform at this time, which was the bow tie and the white shirt with the sleeves rolled up to mm-hmm. a certain point, but it wasn't like a long sleeve shirt, because like it was not that rolled up, it's just very carefully rolled up, mm-hmm. and bartenders were always ripped looking, so it looked really good on them, and I was like, man, that's a good look. I mean, you know, I could go for that look, you know, if I could just get a lot more ripped and become a bartender in the 50s, I guess. But yeah, she basically, what happens is she gets to her motel. She's like, I'm going to see my sister Janet. And then the woman in the motel is like, well, Janet's dead. So she's like, no, it can't be true. She spends 3 days in her motel room having some crying times. But then she decides, basically her plan is...
That was a funny part, actually. I don't want to jump ahead.
Yeah.
She goes to her hotel, finds out that her sister's murdered because she sees it in the paper, goes to her room and cries, and then we get a scene of the employees of the hotel, the innkeeper, basically complaining, and she's acting almost like annoyed that she didn't commit suicide.
Hi, me again. Unfortunately, I couldn't work out a way to stitch the previous section of audio to the next section of audio in any way that was even vaguely seamless, so we're just going to catch up with Peter as he starts to discuss the music of My Body Hungers.
It took me a while to realize, oh, that's supposed to be diegetic music in the bar, because there's no indication of where it's coming from.
That is something we can talk about the music. The music in this film is, again, with the previous Joe Sarno films, and in fact a lot of films of this era, as we have learned from watching these canon movies, is that they just play music. It's nothing to do with what's going on. It doesn't like have any sort of like connection to there's like with George, there's like a really serious scene where he's like, I lied to the police and all that, and the music's just this straight up, smooth, loungy jazz at all times. It's
stuff like that. There's a car chase at one point, which we'll get to much later, that is entirely set to this very, you know,
loungy,
ambling lounge music that is in no way exciting.
Yeah, there's a part where they're driving, and the guy, the police who are doing the chase, they're like, she's going 100 miles an hour! But the music is so smooth, and the footage is so slow, you're like, what? Or no, he goes like, she must be doing 100.
Yeah.
And I was like, 100 miles a week, maybe? I mean, I'm not like... Like, it doesn't seem that fast. It seems like we could get out of the car and walk after her with your hand out. But, I'd say we're introduced to the go-go dancers, and we're introduced to one woman who I'm not clear what she does, because she doesn't seem to be a go-go dancer or really one of the hostesses.
Well, is that the... I think there's a matron of, like, the house who just kind of... She's in charge of everybody.
But maybe? It's not the matron I'm talking about. I'm talking about the massage lady.
Oh, yeah. Who's she... Yeah, yeah.
So, basically, there's this one girl in the house who I think... must be involved somehow, but the thing is...
She's like a coordinator, maybe?
Yeah, maybe. Some sort of coordinator. She's the PR lady. I don't know. Our hero's like, oh, tension headache. Such a bad tension headache. From all the worry about my sister being dead. I didn't say that. I don't have a sister.
Yeah.
But I have a headache. And then her roommate's like, oh, Janet got headaches all the time. But this one woman, she has magic hands. She got rubbed down off her. At that point, literally every single person in the audience goes, this lady did it. Like, because you're like, lesbian murderer, case closed. It's done at that point. But we have to watch the movie for, like, another hour at this point.
Yeah.
But this leads to what is, I would say, the sexual get-your-rocks-off money shot of the movie, I suppose, which is our hero gets into the room, the other lady's wearing a sort of a nighty thing. They're both wearing
nighties.
I'm going
to confess, I fell asleep at this point.
Okay.
But I did wake up later.
They're both wearing... He'd already seen the hardcore business, which I wouldn't look at. So,
yep.
He had to have a little napsy.
Yeah.
But basically, they're wearing, you know, those sort of 60s sort of baby doll things.
Okay.
They're sort of see-through. And she gives her a rub down, basically. It's not erotic or even particularly interesting, but you do see some flesh. So I guess that's the point where people will be like, this is what I've been waiting for the whole movie.
It's around this point in which, I believe it's Marcia? Yeah, Marcia. So Marcia
is our hero, yeah.
I think her fake name was Debbie, though. But yeah. Marcia takes a bath. And it's, like, kind of, I think, might be the only time there's, like, full-on nudity in the movie, even though it's mostly covered by bubbles.
I mean...
She's in a bubble bath.
At no point in this movie, if you're the type of person to keep score, do we get full frontal.
No.
We just get the top off. And we see her top off in the back rub sequence. She full on takes her top off.
Yeah.
This bathtub sequence is, again, one of those classic sort of movie bathtubs where her bath is full of more bubbles than you could ever possibly conceivably imagine.
Yeah.
And then she stands up and immediately wraps her towel around herself,
well, this
even though she's covered in bubbles.
This is the thing. She doesn't stand up initially. She takes the towel and, like, drapes it across the bathtub while she's, like, submerged.
Yeah.
And then gets up. And so the towel is just immediately soaking wet. And
yeah, and covered in bubbles.
So it was very, very odd. It's not really how one does that. And then she gets out of the bathtub and is finally attacked by the mysterious garter belt murderer.
Yeah.
And survives.
Yeah, but again, if you are keeping score on this podcast, I can't quite remember, but I believe it is in To Ingrid My Love Lisa, there is also a confusing Joe Sarno bathtub sequence where our hero does something like, I think they go for a bath and then take a shower straight away after coming out of the bath. When, as we all know, if you want the bath water to stay clean, you shower first,
yeah,
and then you get in the bathtub water so that somebody else can use the bathtub water,
yeah,
which is how they actually do it in Scandinavian countries and Japan and places like that.
Here's the thing, Joe Sarno has just never taken a bath.
He's pretty dirty by the sounds of things. I mean, as I say, I didn't look at the screen, but if you're doing stuff with sausages and hoo-hoos, I don't want to know. But yeah, so she takes a bath, but then here's the point where our garter belt killer, or
yeah,
if that's who it is, potential spoiler, is super confusing. Rather than just wait outside the bathroom to kill
her,
I'm definitely spoiling this, they write down, I am waiting for you in the hallway, and then push that under the door. Now, there's nowhere else for Marcia to go. She's not going to take another door, she's not going to avoid the hallway, she's not going to phase through the wall to her bedroom.
And was the killer trying to pretend that it was a note from George Harvey or the police officer? Because, again, Marcia is already suspicious that someone wants to kill her in this lodge because someone killed her sister. So the idea that she'd read a note and go, okay, I'm going to go down the hallway.
Yeah, I mean, if I, even right now, like in this room where we're talking, if a note came underneath and said, I'm waiting for you in the hallway, I'd be like, I am really, really worried about leaving this hallway.
Yeah.
But she just walks out,
yeah,
you know, in her towel and immediately gets attacked in kind of a way that doesn't make any sense. It's not clear what's going on.
No, it's basically the killer attacks with one arm. And then eventually the killer just goes, this is too awkward.
So awkward, in fact, that it's at this point my tape recording totally failed out again. So here we're going to catch up with Peter as he describes an awkward confrontation with George Harvey, the newspaper man, and Mama's boy.
George Harvey, the newspaper man, and learns that he actually wasn't at the newspaper office. He was planning to run away with Janet and was so excited. This, you might have to help me because I was a little vague on it. Maybe it's in your notes. He was so excited that he was just driving around, like waiting to pick her up, and then realized, oh, I can't tell the cops that. That'll sound really suspicious.
Yeah, basically they have a discussion where she's like, come on, mate. It's pure weird that you would be saying I was at the newspaper place with my mom. That's mental.
Yeah.
I'm from out of town, so clearly that doesn't fly with me. And he's like, look, I was so excited. I was just like in the car alone and no one's going to believe that. So my mother said this would be easier, right? So the mother becomes kind of, you've seen the mother multiple times in this film before, but it's never clear who she is. Because there's a lot of women in this go-go dancing place who don't really have a character.
Mm-hmm.
But it's at this point, kind of unrelated, more or less, because he's not really involved in the plot. He's just there. Our policeman goes, I'm going to get involved in the plot.
And this climax is pretty amazing, I think, just in terms of when you think about conceptually what this cop decides to do.
And it makes, it's kind of clever, almost.
Except how it plays out is ridiculous. Basically, the cop goes, I'm going to basically recreate the circumstances of Janet Tilly's murder and then just wait for the murder to attack, and then that'll be great. Now, the problem I have with this idea is that he does this. So he's basically using Marcia's bait. Marcia goes into the barn expecting to meet George, and they're going to run off. And at this point, the mother shows up and tries to kill
him. Well, we don't know this.
We, A hand comes in to attack her. There's a bit of a fight. It cuts back to the cops, and they're just sitting there not doing anything, as if they already know that, oh yeah, this is just another squabble that's unrelated to the actual killer.
It's quite fantastic. Our cop character, he basically tells one of the go-go dancers, we're going to get married, just don't tell anyone, me and Marcia.
Mm-hmm.
So she immediately runs off and tells everybody, because that's what ladies are like.
Mm-hmm.
But the cop's response is to stand outside and smoke a cigarette. He's like, my work here is done. I've solved the crime.
Yeah, and whoever shows up will be the murderer.
Yeah, once Marcia's dead, I guess we'll have solved the crime. And yes, Marcia gets choked out in a barn, and I can't remember exactly what happens.
Well, she gets choked in the barn, but it's not. It's by George Harvey's mom.
But it's by George's mother, and George just runs in at this point.
Yeah, right? because the reason why this is happening is because George told his mom that he told Marcia that he didn't have a solid alibi, and so George's mom was really worried that Marcia was going to rat him out, so the mom decides, I'm going to kill Marcia. And the cops are like, probably, they're across the street, and they're just witnessing this going on and going, well, I guess she's not the killer, so we're just going to let this squabble play out.
For a Joe Sarno movie, this is a remarkably complex plot, because normally it is like a sort of like more, they're more like emotional dramas, right? They're more like a woman has come to town and she causes problems between, she basically causes like a love triangle.
Yeah,
right?
They're
always fairly strict. This is one that actually has like, it sort of like fakes you out, you think.
Yeah.
Because it's like, it could be the mother. I mean, it's often the mother in these sort of, you know, sort of dramas like that. Because like, the whole thing is set up with George. Like, there is a whole red heading plot.
Yeah.
But then, I guess Joe just goes, you know what, I'm bored of this. Let's just finish it. So basically the cops, I think, do the cops come in?
The cops don't even come in, that's the thing.
Yeah, basically it's George.
George comes in, takes the mother away while Marcia's just coughing and going, oh, I'm glad I survived that.
But somebody says something, I think maybe Marcia or something, she's like, well, if the mother didn't do it, who did do it?
Yeah.
And then basically the lady with the magic hands, the lesbian murderer, just comes and goes, it was me and I'm going to kill you now.
Yeah.
Like she just sort of jumps out. And it's at this point the cops are like, well, we've got a girl. And they put their cigarettes out quickly. And they run in. And then they are the least effective cops of all time.
They come in guns drawn.
They have their guns drawn.
But the lesbian masseuse has tied the garter belt around Marsha's neck and says, "I could break her neck in a second, so don't even try and shoot." And the cops go, okay. And they throw their guns on the ground.
Yeah, he's like, "Throw your guns in those bushes." And then they watch her walk slowly to her car and, like, put Marsha in.
And then at this point, when they get to the car, too, they reach behind them as if they have more guns.
More guns, yeah. Which... because these cops, you know, it's like, they have a gun in their back.
In their back holster, I guess.
They have a gun at their ankle, probably. Yeah. They have some guns.
So they're loaded, but then at that point, she's like, "Oh, I gotta remind you, I could break," which seems like, I mean, they do set her up as having magic hands, so maybe that's why she could break her neck so fast, because I kept going, like, this is... kind of ridiculous.
Yeah, I just love the idea that, like, these two men, like, are like, "Well, I guess we just are helpless now."
Yeah, and this plan didn't really work out.
Our enemy has a garter belt around our Marsha's throat. So, as we know, a garter belt is the strongest substance known to man. And if she just tightens that, her entire head will pop off. Yeah. So there's nothing we can do. And as I said, this then leads to the slowest, most lounge jazziest chase I have ever experienced in a movie. And again, the cops are useless in this sequence. Yeah. The cops basically, so I believe our murderess is traveling probably about 20 miles an hour or something.
Probably.
Our cops are following about 20. It's a nice slow speed chase. And again, they're like, "I don't really know what we can do." And Marsha's just like, "Do you know what? Fuck this. I've had enough." I just, like, jumps out of the car.
Yep.
And the murderer's reaction to this is to be like, "No, Marsha, no!" And then just immediately crash the car over a ravine.
Yep.
The cops arrive, and their reaction is also amazingly kind of ineffectual. They sort of look at the car, which has kind of started to go on fire.
Yep.
And they're like, "Well, I guess we should watch this for a while."
Yeah.
And Marsha screams, "Oh my god, she's burning." And this is all, you have to remember, this is all happening with the smoothest, loungiest jazz music in the background. And we hear a woman screaming and burning to death. And one of the cops goes, "Judas Priest," which apparently was an exclamation at the time.
Yeah.
He wasn't like, "Oh man, Rob Halford's got to see this man, it was sick." He's just like freaked out. In fact, this was another amazing thing about our panel.
Yeah.
Our panel were confused as to when Judas Priest formed. They thought maybe Judas Priest had formed before 1967. They were like, maybe he was referring to Judas Priest. I'm like, what?
I feel like Tim was on that, like, "No, that's probably not the case." But I wasn't so sure about Nicholas winding referee. He did seem to give that some pause.
Some pause, the idea that the Judas Priest had formed before, like around the time of the Rolling Stones, which is clearly not the case. And then that in the Joe Sarno film, he was like, "Do you know, it'd be cool if this guy referenced Judas Priest at this point."
Yeah, because maybe he was just like, "Oh, this would be a great album cover, this image of a burning."
Yeah, but so the cops stand and they watch a car burn and a woman scream. And when the screaming stops, one cop just goes, "There's nothing we can do for her now." You're like, you can go into the car and you can save this woman's life, maybe.
See, this kind of ending, I think, was a popular ending of the period. It does kind of remind me of the ending to Blood Feast, where the cops chase the bad guy, into a garbage truck, and then just stand there as the garbage truck compresses him, and they go, "Well, he's dead, like the garbage he was." And it's just so pat and kind of like, we didn't really try to do anything. So, yeah.
Yeah, and then that ending was pretty fantastic. Yeah, I mean, that happens, and then, of course, you go back to our newsreader, who's like, "And finally, the sleepy town of New Haven can go back to its normal life. Or can it?" And then it ends, and I was like, that's great. Yeah. I actually, the ending, with the smooth jazz, the ridiculous car chase, a woman burning to death with the cops just watching, it kind of actually made it pan out, where if I'd come up on stage afterwards, I'd have been like, "That was kind of boring, but the ending was amazing."
Yeah.
And I was kind of surprised that people were so down on it in the end.
They seemed down on it until they started talking about it. And then at that point, they kind of retrospectively went, "Oh, well, this stuff was kind of interesting and kind of neat." But yeah, they definitely clearly weren't happy with it. What I want to know, though, as someone who's only heard you guys describe Joe Sarno movies, where would you place this in the current I guess we can't add this to the canon.
Canon to the Sarno canon.
But because I think this podcast might potentially deviate. You might find yourself doing a Sarno podcast. Like,
Yeah, we had a discussion. Someone wrote in about, I forget who it was, maybe Will Sloan wrote in and said, which person would you do another podcast about? For example, a Sarno podcast. And I was like, I will blow my brains out.
Maybe Will, if you're listening, you should start that. That'd be a great mission.
Actually, there is the chance. So one of the nice things about having come down to Fantastic Fest, sort of with Loose Cannons, is, as you'll know listening to this podcast so far, when you look at stuff like Joe Sarno, it's hard to find information. There are definitely people here who are real canon fanatics, people who work at the Draft House. So hopefully we're going to be able to talk to some of those people in maybe future podcasts, if they aren't.
If not, we'll cut it out of this podcast.
Yeah. If they're not offended by how uneducated we are by these movies. But yeah, I mean, it comes to the Sarno canon, as it were. This one comes pretty high, I think.
Yeah, so what would you rank higher than this?
I mean, like, I think that, I think, like, Inga is probably still the most interesting one, probably that we've seen, because it is so much like a weird drama. It was the first one I saw, so the first one always kind of like hits you kind of hard, right? But this one is interesting because it has higher stakes than his movies have had up to that point. They're always just about, there's a love triangle. Do you know what I mean? Like, whereas this one is like, a woman has been murdered, and how am I going to shoot that? The problem with the movie is that, like all the other movies, there are large swathes of the movie which is just a woman go-go dancing, or, although there is no active sex in this movie, something sort of sexual happening that's actually crazy boring. But if you're looking for a Joe Sarno film to watch, as a the Loose Cannons podcast, I'm still going to say it's got to be Inga, because it's a canon film. But this one was worth watching, and I'm a person who would rather kill himself than watch any more Joe Sarno films at this point, probably, so.
I really want to see, though, these ones that apparently are good, like, I found the exact name, it's Confessions of a Young American.
Yeah, Confessions of a Young American and Ride a Pink Horse are supposed to be the ones that, Nick is Running Ren specifically said, Ride a Pink Horse was a good one, and Confessions of a Young American Housewife? It's supposed to be the other. I genuinely think that they're on the Sarno level, where people think they're good because they are shot interestingly, but the content is just kind of dull, I bet. And I think that it's just because the first one you see, you think it's interesting because it's not. So many exploitation films are just bad, right? Whereas films are not, Joe Sarno films are not just bad, clearly until he gets to the porno period of his life where he probably has just given up. I imagine he has to have given up by that point.
Yeah.
They're still really, really boring. But I think we can put My Body Hungers into the can, as it were.
Yeah.
And normally in this podcast, what we make an effort to do is to recommend a film in the style of the movie we watch. But for this one, I think that we should discuss the other movies of Fantastic Fest that we've seen so far that we think the audience should look out for. So what's the first, what's the Fantastic Fest movie that you'd like to talk about now?
Can I talk about what we just watched?
Of course you can.
Okay, because we just came out of a secret screening at Fantastic Fest. Fantastic Fest likes to do secret screenings where you don't know what you're getting into. However, in the case of this one, I think if you read enough blog posts on Birth, Movies, Death, or on the Fantastic Fest blog, you might have been able to figure out. It's actually a film the Draft House has just picked up. It's called Dangerous Men, by John Rad. It is in the pantheon of movies that some would call so bad they're good, but you know, I would prefer to call something as just plain eccentric cinema. If you've seen films like Miami Connection, Gedevan, and Fateful Findings, you kind of know what to expect. I don't think it's as good as either of those movies, but it was definitely a worthy entry into the what the hell am I watching sort of series of movies. I'm going to quickly synopsize it. I don't know if that is even possible. It's a biker movie / rape revenge film about a couple that get attacked on the beach by two bikers. The man dies. The woman runs off and decides to become a vigilante.
But that's not important.
But that's not important because the movie then focuses on the brother of the man who's murdered as he tries to kill a member of the same gang
who has nothing to do with the original murder.
Yeah, nothing to do with the original murder. His name is Black Pepper, and then even in the climax, that original brother gets just kind of knocked out and is not even participating in the climax, which is instead occurs in a blind woman's house. It's just nuts. The music is all scored by the director, and it is a series of thrown out Mega Man compositions.
Yeah.
Or something that would belong in like a Capcom street side scroller street brawler. It's pretty hilarious. It's also pretty boring, but boring in that kind of bad movie purgatory sense that I find somewhat enjoying. Like I said, it's not, I think if you go in expecting this to be as, to escalate as much as Fateful Findings does, or to be as consistently entertaining as Miami Connection is, you might be disappointed. But if you're a fan of weirdo cinema and eccentric cinema, I think you will have a great time with Dangerous Men.
Yeah, you know, traditionally on this podcast, we listen to each other's recommendations graciously, and we, you know, we go, oh, that sounds interesting. I also sat through Dangerous Men, and I'm going to break the you know, the habit of a lifetime by saying Peter is too nice.
Yeah.
I think it was interesting in a boring sort of way, because it was kind of like a movie made by someone who kept getting hit on the head and forgetting what he'd made.
Yeah, it was like a director with no short-term memory.
But it's really, really, for me, it was very low in the rung of so bad it's good movies. I think it's probably if you're obsessed with this type of cinema.
Which I am.
Yeah, like, then it's like, there's no reason not to see it. But if you're like the type of person who, because I know people, in fact, I shall not name this person, but they were doing a movie marathon recently and they watched Miami Connection and they didn't like it. And I was like, this person is crazy. And then they immediately tweeted how much they like Kung Fury afterwards. Mm. And I was like, I must find this person and kill them. Because some people just, you know, they don't like things that aren't as straightforward. And this one is very not straightforward in terms of the so bad it's good type of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's one of the reasons, actually watching this movie is one of the reasons why this podcast, we were having such a hard time remembering what happened in My Body Hungers. Because it kind of just blasts your neurons off your brain, you know? You're just like, what is going on? Like, I don't understand.
Which is why I enjoyed it, quite frankly, so.
But, yeah, I mean, it's definitely a recommendation that somebody could make. Dangerous Men. Do you think, so that'll be coming out as part of the Drafthouse imprint, you think?
Yeah, they've just released the teaser now. You can find, you probably see it on Birth Movies Death or on the Fantastic Fest website. So, yeah, people will be able to get their hands on that.
It's just I would say, you're probably, if you're the type of person who wants to see this, you're probably going to see it. Just don't buy into the crazy hype it's probably going to get on these type of websites of, like, the next Miami Connection. Just consider it, like, an interesting example of this, what has more or less become a genre.
Yeah,
The lost movie that's really weird made by a one singular,
like an expat
vision,
from,
you know,
some Middle Eastern country.
Yeah.
I'm going to try and think of something good, though, if you want.
Well, I have to talk about Stand By for Tape Backup.
Okay, yep.
Because this is a movie which I saw listed at Hot Docs, and I saw it, you know, you mentioned a few times, and overall I thought, well, I don't know if that how interesting it actually sounds, right? The concept is this guy, Ross Sutherland.
Yep.
He found a tape in his loft, actually, that belonged to his grandfather, and he, all he does in the movie is fast forward and rewind and show you parts of this tape, which had been recorded over multiple times at different eras and different positions, and talk, rap, and basically do poetry over the top about what this footage kind of means to him. And when we sort of read that as a synopsis, it started as a fringe show in Edinburgh. He used to do it live. In fact, he will probably be doing it live probably one more time coming up in New York. I don't exactly know when that is.
I think it's October 9th or something. Yeah. It's in the next two weeks.
Okay, well, we might have missed it, but it is one of, I keep using this phrase because I know how totally hyperbolic it is, but I genuinely consider it a transformative piece of art. Like, it's one of the, it's so easy for people to take, like, found footage and do something arty over the top, and it always sucks, but this is someone who's taken something incredibly personal to them and shared them in a way which should speak to more or less anyone, because it talks to something which I think is very universal to anyone who exists in this era, which is that recorded media forms part of our history, and it is part of how we contextualize how our past, essentially. Because everyone, everyone has the memories of the first film they saw in the cinema. Everyone has the memory of, you know, a parent or somebody like, so it's like, so, you know, it's like going to see Star Wars films with, you know, your mom or something, or things like that. There's all these moments, or the things you'd watch on television together. And then it's when we revisit these things, they sort of reveal things about ourselves, and he does it in such an incredibly educated fashion that is so powerful that it more or less crushed me completely. And a lot of people I've spoke to about it, they had a strong, visceral, like, tearful reaction to how... And it's such a hopeful movie in the end as well. It's not just purely about the past. It's about the future and how we have to have that past and deal with it and hold it with us in a way to be human. And I think that it's probably the film that I will talk about for a long time as that film that people simply must see. Like, you must see this movie.
The director refers to the film and the video cassette in question that features in the movie as this kind of church. And quite frankly, like, I want to own this VHS cassette and I want to play it every Sunday.
Yeah, I mean, much like the filmmaker who part of the things he discusses is the fact that he is atheist rather than religious in any way. And I'm not atheist. I'm definitely agnostic. But I do feel that the artifact is an interesting kind of thing to return to, even though it's actually someone else's history and memories, because it just allows you to connect to your own self in a way that religion does for people. So that's kind of a fascinating thing. Again, I am talking so strongly and so positively that when you start to watch this movie, because it does start, actually it starts very, with something that's very, kind of a tired concept almost, but it's only so that you can then sort of blow your mind, I think, later on.
Yeah.
You'll start and you'll be like, this doesn't sound as interesting as Matthew's made it out to be. So much like Dangerous Men, I suppose I'll say, don't like get super hyped to see it. You just have to see it and take what you can from it. But I thought it was incredible and a must see.
It's my number one of the year. I can't think of another film that has touched me so well.
Absolutely. It's definitely, in terms of movies I've seen in years, it's probably...
And don't be afraid of it not working if you don't have a chance to see it live. Matthew, you saw it pre-taped.
I saw it taped, but I am actually considering... I don't think I can get to New York for August 9th, but October 9th.
9th and 10th.
But I'm like genuinely considering going down just because I did meet the director afterwards and he's really nice. And I was like, well, I could go down. We could hang out afterwards.
Yeah, I might go too. So, hey.
Yeah. So, but I think that's 45 minutes. So we can wrap out Loose Cannons now. Remember, if you enjoy the podcast, if you have any questions about the movies or any comments you want to make, you can write to us at loosecannonspodcast@gmail.com. We are always willing to get your letters. And if you enjoy the podcast, please share it. And the best thing you can do for us is to give reviews on iTunes, because that aids us with discoverability, apparently. So please, 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 please give us reviews on iTunes if you like the podcast. If you don't like the podcast, write us a letter, and then we'll see what we can do, because then we'll have your address.
Also, follow me at Peter Kapowski.
Oh, that's cute. Follow Peter at Peter Kapowski on Twitter. I'm at Matthew Kumar, actually, if you're interested in doing that.
And if you're interested in the Laser Blast Film Society, which Justin, who's usually the co-host here, you can check out laserblastfilmsociety.com.
I was your host, Matthew Kumar. I was with...
Peter Kapowski.
That's fantastic!
Yay!